views and opinions expressed therein are those of the individual speakers and callers and do not necessarily represent the views of KFAR Radio or any of our respective employees, affiliates, or sponsors of this program.
Problems, problems, problems all day long.
Good morning, Fairbanks. You're listening to KFAR Radio. We are 660 AM or 97.5 on the FM dial. And this is Problem Corner, and I am your guest host, Nick Nugent, filling in for Dave Pruse, who's off serving the city today. If you'd like to call in, you can do so by calling 458-TALK or 458-8255, and we will try to get to your call. Today is Wednesday, so the topic will be something historical, and I think we have a very interesting program lined up today. Our subject is going to be the very early years of aviation in Valdez and Cordova. So about 1928, 1930 to 1932 in that area. The easiest place maybe to start would be the activities of the Alaska Road Commission, and by 1927 October, they were almost finished with the airfield on the flats near the town site of Valdez. Interestingly, there were no pilots in Valdez at the time, and Valdez, though, had contributed 40% of the cost of building an airfield. That was the commission's policy. They also agreed to clear the site. When they cleared the site, literally everyone in town turned out, children, adults, teams of horses, rakes, stump pullers, anything you can imagine. People wanted an airport, and they were boosters of the airport. So Valdez had, of course, been a transportation center for a lot of years. The port was ice-free. They had access to the interior by use of the Richardson Trail and others. And there were, though, no aircraft or pilots available right at this time. Well, one resident, Owen E. Mills, who was the owner of the local Ford dealership and garage, would be changing that. Mills boarded the SS Alaska in late November of 1927. He was leaving just a bit later than planned. His father, A.J. Mills, had died on October 23rd. The elder Mills had come up to Alaska during the rush of 98, and in 1903, the family was moved to Valdez to settle. Owen was 13 and one of six children at that point. Find out that in these days, a lot of auto owners got into the aircraft business. They had mechanics, they had shops. They had a number of things going for them. So Mills then decided that he would open some type of an aircraft operation. And in those days, there were actually quite a few aircraft manufacturers, much like the auto industry in those days. Well, Owen had sent the Alexander Aircraft Company of Denver a deposit on one of their Eagle Rock biplanes. Mills had been preparing by taking a home study course from the Aviators Preparatory Institute of New York and reading everything that he could find. He concluded his business with Ford, which was in Seattle. There was a large Ford factory there at the time. And he was off for Denver. He went to the Alexander factory and enrolled for flying lessons with their chief pilot, Cloyd Clevenger. Owen spent the remainder there of the winter there. He also took classes in aircraft manufacturing and repair. Along with the purchase of his new three-pace biplane, he negotiated an agency to sell the Alexander Company's aircraft in Alaska. Well, Owen was a man that when he was doing something, he moved pretty quickly. He arrived back in Seattle by March 21st. He boarded the SS Yukon on the 24th to Valdez, and on March 30th, married Nancy Sanderson, a local school teacher who'd been a local school teacher for the prior 2 years. So Owen got things done. Owen also built a temporary hangar on Broadway near the Ford dealership, and he planned to erect the plane in May to be ready for the start of the flying season. His plan was to be ready to deliver passengers and freight to the mines and nearby communities. By June 9th, the plane was assembled. The final touches were put on the runway, and they were pretty well ready to go. So this Eagle Rock was powered by a Curtiss OX-5 with only 90 horsepower, but it could carry two passengers and the pilot who flew from the rear cockpit. He named it the Spirit of Valdez. Meals also lettered the name of the company, Meals Eagle Rock Sales Company, on the fuselage. So he advertised his franchises a little bit more than he did as an airline. In a place as small as Valdez, everybody knew he had an airline. Owen was able then to take off at 5:10 p.m. on June 11th, leveled off at 7,000 feet, and circled around the valley for nearly an hour. He returned to the field and took his wife Nancy up as his first passenger. Owen practiced a lot of landings for a few days. He was pretty meticulous. He really made sure he knew what he was doing. On June 17th, he took his first paying passenger, Andrew Morovich, up for a sightseeing hop. Those were $10 per person at that time. During the time Owens was doing all of these sightseeing flights, one of his passengers was a young man, 13-year-old. And that was Bill Egan, who later became a three-time governor of the state of Alaska, never lost his interest in aviation. On June 27th, he and Morovich almost became the first to land at Cordova's 17-mile landing site, but the windsock was down, and the winds were rather treacherous that day, so they didn't take the chance, not wanting to get blown off into the Copper River. He tried again on July 3rd, again with two passengers this time, and they also, again, had to return to Valdez as weather prevented a landing. A lot of his passengers during this time were flight seers and people just wanting to take hops, and several of them were actually repeat flyers. Well, some of the first aerial images in the Prince William Sound area were made by a photographer, Howard Stewart, starting on July 27th. Owen, also that day, had Stewart as a passenger and Ruth Statz. They took off for Fairbanks at 1:09 p.m., arrived at Weeks Field in Fairbanks at 6 p.m. They carried some mail and a letter from Valdez Mayor F.A. Diamond to Fairbanks Mayor Frank DeLaverne. His return didn't go as well, though. There was a strong headwind, and after crossing the Alaska Range, weather began to obscure visibility. He hoped to land at the well-marked airfield at Copper Center, but had to turn back, hoping for a landing spot near Gakona. The headwinds had taken more fuel than expected, and they ended up having to make a quick emergency landing on a sandbar in the Copper River, and that went very badly. They smashed the airplane up. And this will be a good spot, I believe, to do some commercial breaks. Please stay with us. We will be right back.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
We're talking men's health with Dr. Tony Nima from Fairbanks Urology. Is the PSA test reliable for prostate cancer?
You got to think of the PSA blood test as testing for something that should be in your prostate but shouldn't be in your blood. If the PSA is up in the bloodstream, that means it's leaking out of the prostate, either because of something going on in the prostate or because of prostate cancer.
Find out more about men's health at Fairbanks Urology with Dr. Tony Nima online at fairbanksurology.com.
Hey, Fairbanks, it's still dark as a well digger's elbow at night, and as the snow gets deeper, the moose start using the roads for trails. Moose lights save lives, and to help keep your family safe, Auto Trim Design is offering 15% off all Vision X LED moose lights when we professionally install them for you. So keep your family safe, save some bucks, and see us for your moose lights today at Auto Trim Design, 2550 South Cushman.
As we always say, we will be here when the other guys are gone.
KFAR weather.
Sunshine mixed with clouds at times today, with daytime highs approaching 36. Southeasterly winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Partly cloudy skies again tonight, lows dip down to about 18. Cloudy skies expected tomorrow, chance for snow, highs around 30. About an inch of snow tomorrow. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM.
Well, welcome back, Fairbanks. We are returning to resume our discussion with myself about the early years of aviation, the beginning of aviation in Valdez and Cordova. If you'd like to call in, you can do so again by calling 458-TALK, which is also 458-8255. We'll try to get to your calls. Well, we had just mentioned that Owen had run out of gas, and the plane was running so roughly they landed it, and it smashed up on landing. The witnesses had seen the accident and set a rescue in place. It turns out there were no boats available at Gakona, so one was trucked over from Sourdough. While crossing, the boat swamped, and it and the occupants were carried fairly far downstream before they could get to shore and be rescued and brought in. At this point, Slim Williams and John McCrary, who you may remember were famous for their motorcycle exploits a few years later promoting the a highway to Alaska, happened on the site, and they used a tarpaulin over a boat frame, which happened to be there, and they were able to cross. It was a pretty perilous crossing. That wasn't the world's most sturdy boat, and certainly in the Copper River, there was a lot of twisting and turning with it. They did, though, have to make several trips because they found out Mrs. Statt's legs had gone through the fuselage and were tangled in the crumpled landing gear. Stewart, the photographer, had broken both legs. And interestingly, Owen Meals was not hurt, but he was trapped in the crumpled aircraft. So John and Slim made several crossings. They got tools. They extricated Mrs. Statt's and Meals. Dr. D'Arcy Chase drove all night from Valdez to help, and he prepared Mrs. Statt's and Stewart for excavation and evacuation. So they were taken to Chitna by auto, then on to the Kennecott Hospital by rail speeder. Stewart and Mrs. Statt's both survived, but both were restricted in mobility from that point on. Mrs. Statt's actually confined to a wheelchair for the rest of her life. Meals was transported by auto to Valdez and recovered. Later, a fund was established to help support the injured parties. Local people, still wanting an airline, also contributed $1,400 toward the purchase of a new plane. Usable parts were salvaged from the plane, and Owen ordered a second aircraft to be delivered in 1929. An interesting aside about this aircraft that was wrecked. In 1932, a young pilot asked if he could rebuild it and fly it. He did that. That young, sort of unknown pilot was Bob Reeves, and that was the start of Reeves Aleutian Airlines. Well, what led to become Reeves Aleutian Airlines. Over to Cordova, 1929, they were still waiting for a first plane to arrive. They had a deep water port served by a lot of Seward-bound steamers and the railroad to the mines at Kennecott, so it was a pretty good transportation hub also. This activity, shipping ore, kept the economy going well, and A.A. Bennett had tried on March 3rd, Bennett, a pilot and air service owner here in Fairbanks, tried on March 13th to bring Neil Rice, a vice president of the FE company, to catch the steamship Yukon to Seattle. He was unable to make it due to bad weather, had to turn back to Fairbanks. So there have been three attempts made, this one by Bennett and the two by Means. Cordova's Chamber of Commerce had an active airplane committee and had four sites under consideration. There was a Nelson Townsite field, which wasn't a good field. It was too close to steeply rising terrain. The ballpark nearest the city was ruled out because of the amount of fill they'd have to bring in. Mile 13 along the railroad was a pretty good site, except it didn't drain well, so there could be water on the field a lot. And the best site looked to be at mile 17 along the railroad, could be used rather inexpensively. On May 24, 1928, Governor Parks and Robert Summers arrived to investigate sites, and they chose the mile 17 site. There were no roads that far out of town, so any air activity that took place there would depend on the railroad to get the rest of the way into Cordova. Vern C. Gorst was involved in this area also. He operated Gorst Air Transport Incorporated. He was an old Alaskan, having come north during the Klondike Rush. He spent 7 years there mining, and now at age 58, was an ardent flyer. Another of his operations was the Seattle Flying Service. In late April of 1929, he made a flight up through southeastern Alaska to check on opportunities. While doing that, Gorst was contracted to transport six members of Alaska's legislature from Juneau to Cordova. On May 1st, Clayton Scott, their chief pilot, took off with the mechanic Gordon Graham, and they had a Keystone loaning air yacht, which was a good airplane for Prince William Sound. It was amphibious. It could land on water or land. They arrived in Ketchikan on the 3rd of May, and they were headed on to Sitka to pick up some members of the legislature. They, though, the legislators, were beginning to waffle at the cost of $125 each. So Scott took the time to head on to Juneau, picked up passengers there for other locations. That was pretty common in these days. There certainly was no one forcing you to fly to a particular schedule or publish rates, for that matter. They then returned to Ketchikan. Scott flew very slowly around the SS Alaskan, which was an astute move. They sold numerous hops to many people who had been on the passenger ship. On May 7th, they were making final preparations for the flight to Cordova, and Scott noticed the mailbags in the aircraft moved. He pulled them back to see why and discovered there were two young women trying to stow away. They were removed without ceremony. They had actually brought champagne and lunches with themselves. They were away at 10:41, reached Cordova, skirting fog most of the way at 3 in the afternoon, landed in the bay, but due to the tides, hopped over to Ayak Lake. That became sort of the standard landing place for planes on floats. It was close, it was easy to get to, and it had pretty good conditions most of the time. They made a lot of round trips to Valdez over the next few days, and each took about 45 minutes. One day when they reached Valdez, the photographer steward married Miss Henrietta Brown in the air, in the float plane, and that was a first for Alaska Aviation. On May 11th, they made a number of flights, culminating with one to Anchorage, where they were escorted into town by Russ Merrill and Frank Dorbin, both pretty well-known aviation names. The president and grand manager General Manager of Anchorage Air Transport, A.A. Schoenbeck, hosted a dinner for the crew and Cordova visitors, and they were followed that up by a dance at the Pioneers of Alaska Hall. Scott started making flights to Latouche, Hinchinbrook, Tyonek, and other towns. And for a plane that was an amphibious plane, it was pretty well suited to do these flights. It also was fairly fast, so it was a good choice for everyone there. So Scott flew a rather unusual mission on May 15th. He had the head of Piggly Wiggly Markets in Alaska, who had to get to Juneau and found out his ship had sailed. Scott took off after the steamer and caught up to it near Cape Hinchinbrook. They made a water landing and taxied to the ship successfully, transferring the passenger. Scott was also able to deliver two radio technicians to the Cape Hinchinbrook Naval Radio Station. After a while, Gorst published a table of fares to more frequent destinations, and he started some of the first sightseeing flights to the Columbia Glacier. He also dropped off groups of fishermen and did very well with that. That became a useful adjunct to his business. Toward the end of May, Scott decided to check the potential for hunting on Hinchinbrook Island at Port Etches. The landing went well. Some of the passengers stalked a brown bear but were unsuccessful. By this time, lowered tides had stranded the plane, and when the tides were again favorable, the winds were quite high and rain held them back. At noon the next day, when it cleared up, they were unable to start the motor because the magnetos were totally soaked by blowing rain. On the next morning, a ship was signaled, and the ship, the General Pershing, responded and helped dry out the parts. Well, they finally reached Cordova around 7 p.m. on Tuesday. Having set out at about 5:30 a.m. the prior Sunday. So in that day, that era, if you were going somewhere by air, you needed to be willing to put up with layovers, stops, and holds on your flight. Gorst wanted to expand their business, and a chance arose in early June with two passengers needing to fly to Seattle and one to Juneau. So they departed for Seattle on June 3, 1929, made fuel stops in Yakutat, Juneau, Ketchikan, where they overnighted. The next day, they were off again with a stop at Alert Bay, British Columbia, and then a final 3 hours into Seattle. There, at their regular home base, the Alaskan, which they had dubbed this aircraft, was refurbished. It had had a month of pretty tough use in Cordova, saltwater area, so they decided to really check it out good. Gorst Air had acquired another air yacht from the factory at this time. They started an air ferry service between Bremerton and Seattle, which is only a 12-minute hop, cost $2.50 for passengers. By August 15th of that year, they had made 834 round trips and carried 9,458 passengers. They became so busy with this Puget Sound business that they did not return to Cordova until July of 1930. The ability to carry six passengers and be amphibious again gave Gorst quite an edge in the Prince William Sound country. Back to Valdez in 1929. And with that, I hear our bumper music starting, ladies and gentlemen, and we will take a break for Fox News at this point. Thank you for listening to Problem Corner.
KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
President Biden's brother James Biden giving closed-door testimony to the House impeachment investigation of the president. Maryland Representative Jamie Raskin says House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer impeachment probe not going very well.
It feels to me as if everyone knows the impeachment investigation is over. I think Chairman Comer has said publicly that it doesn't look like the support is there for impeachment.
South Carolina Representative Nancy Mace on the Fox News Channel talking about migrant encounters at the southern border. She says it's a key issue in this upcoming election.
Joe Biden's approval rating on immigration and the border is suffering at 26%. The vast majority of Americans, regardless of their political party affiliation, do not support Joe Biden on the border.
The president criticizing Republicans are blocking a deal that included stricter border security measures. America's listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
Alaska's News Source reports a recent report from the Small Business Administration found that hundreds of billions of dollars from coronavirus relief programs may have been subject to fraud. The agency estimated that at least 17% of the relief funds may have been distributed to potentially fraudulent actors, which comes out to more than $200 billion. Now a COVID-19 fraud task force in Alaska, made up of the U.S. Attorney's Office, FBI, IRS, the Small Business Administration, and U.S. Department of Treasury is tasked with investigating and prosecuting individuals who swindled money away from relief programs. In Alaska, U.S. Attorney S. Lane Tucker said in an interview on Monday that translates to millions of dollars, if not more. Those agencies have been investigating COVID-19 fraud since the very beginning, and that has recently been formalized, and all of the agencies are working together because different agencies gave out different money, Tucker said. In one case, an Anchorage woman is accused of fraudulently obtaining and laundering roughly $1 million in relief funds.
Streaming live online at KFAR660.com.
Own the road. Ride on the Cooper Discoverer AT3 family of all-season tires from GCR Tires and Service. Redefine the limits of Alaska's ever-changing roads. AT3 means all season, on and off the road. Designed for aggressive performance on rocks, loose gravel, snow, ice, and mud, yet exceptionally quiet and responsive on the road. Own the road. Ride on the Cooper Discoverer AT3 family of tires. Buy yours at GCR Tires and Service, the Tire Guys. Taming the Alaskan Road, Van Horn at Cushman.
Erickson Events is proud to present Drake Milligan in concert this Saturday at the Spur. Doors open at 7, music at 8. Get your tickets now at ericksonevents.com.
I need to kind of settle down and let myself get wrapped around somebody's finger, but if I had you, baby, sounds like something I do.
Drake Milligan, back-to-back number one hits on the iTunes country charts, with appearances on The Kelly Clarkson Show, The Grand Ole Opry, CMA Music Festival, Stagecoach, and just recently on America's Got Talent Fantasy League.
Your kiss tastes like whiskey, and I'm a drinker.
Brought to you by The Spur and the Westmark Hotel and Conference Center. Don't miss Drake Milligan with Kendall Marvel this Saturday at The Spur.
These boots need to keep to stepping. That dress needs to keep on spinning around.
This is an Erickson Unlimited event.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Welcome back, everyone, to KFAR's Problem Corner. We're going to resume our discussion about the early aviation in Cordova and Valdez with myself, Nick Nugent. If you, again, would like to try and call in, you can do so by dialing 458-TALK, which is also 458-8255. We'll do our best to get to your call. Okay, we're talking about the one company that seemed to be doing quite well, Gorst Air. The problem for the Cordova Valdez area is Gorst was able to make so much money in Seattle, in the Puget Sound area, that he pulled away from the Alaska market for a little bit. They were doing, they charged $2.50 for passengers and had hauled 9,458 passengers in about 3 months. So you can see why it would have hesitated to come back to a more unknown market. Well, now it's spring of 1929, and we're looking at Valdez for the year of 29. There had been no activity at the airfield in Valdez since Meehl's accident. Meehl's sat out for the States. He purchased a replacement aircraft, another of the same. He returned to Valdez, and by the time he got back, Clayton Scott, who we were just talking about, name was in the register. So there's now two names finally in the airport register in Valdez. And again, the flights that Clayton did usually had some airmail with them. They had some from the letters from Cordova's mayor to the Valdez mayor, and a little bit of a sting to the Valdez miner, to the editor, inquiring as to how their aviation business was doing in Valdez. Well, Meehl's second Alexander Eagle Rock arrived. This one had 180 horsepower Hispano Suiza liquid-cooled motor, so twice the horsepower of his first aircraft, which would have given him a lot more ability to get into smaller airstrips, to fly around obstacles, and it was an improvement, even though it might have at first looked like the same aircraft. That aircraft made its first flight on July 9th, 1929. But from then until the 1st of August, Meehl's shot a number of landings, took a few familiarization flights. His first paying passengers were not taken up till August 31st. On September 8th, he took a couple of passengers on a flight-seeing trip and went up again on August 31st. It seems as though he might have been a little bit shy from the disastrous effects which came from wrecking the first airplane. One of his flight-seeing passengers, though, was Ed Lairdall. He was a mechanic for the Valdez Transportation Company. He liked it so well that he took flying lessons and became a pilot himself. On September 19th, Joe Crossan arrived in town to aid in the search for Russell Merrill. Crossan tried the Eagle Rock, but did not use it in the search for Merrill. I think we'll cover Merrill in a future program since we're branching out aviation a little bit away from Fairbanks. Certainly an interesting character and well worth bringing to the program. Well, the SS Alaska had a captain. His name was Alexander. Every time they were in port, Alexander came by for a flight just to see the scenery. He's a steamship captain, but he absolutely loved flying. Meehl's became quite busy with his Ford dealership and was flying less and less, mostly flight-seeing trips. He put the plane away for the winter on October 29th, 1929, after a fairly slow self-enforced flying season. Well, back to Cordova. Cordova had spent the winter and spring of 1930 without any aircraft activity. In mid-April, Harold Gillum, another name we know well in Fairbanks, and certainly in the aviation community in mid-April, he arrived on business. Gillum owned two Swallow aircraft, which were a biplane, three-seater, three-passenger, similar, I guess, to Meehl's aircraft. His plan was to base his headquarters at Chitna and fly out of Copper Center, hoping to bring things by rail to Chitna, use the really good airfield at Copper Center, and beat some of the coastal weather that socked in the mountain passes so often. He had just finished hauling 2,000 pounds of cargo and two passengers to Snag River for the Shoshana Mines Incorporated, and while there, he was boosting an airfield with the business community. When the ARC inspection team again visited a 17-mile airstrip, they found that ice jam and season's overflow had damaged the prior work. So they needed to adjust drainage for permanent use, and that led to the project being postponed until 1931. The first flight in that year landed on floats at Ayuk Lake, and it belonged to the Alaska-Washington Airways. They had brought a party looking to locate a new fish processing plant, and they had flown over from Juneau. On the 17th, they flew on to Bristol Bay. A lot of the canneries, of course, had same ownership, and there was a fair bit of flying, moving cannery officials back and forth at different times. Well, they, on the 17th, went to Bristol Bay. The aircraft was a Lockheed Vega, wonderful airplane, and it was very suited for the conditions. On June 20th, they returned through Cordova en route to Juneau. Well, the repaired and regraded 17-mile airfield was used by Gillam to haul supplies to small mining and exploration outfits. The big mines, many of them were located and would get their supplies by rail. So Gillam did a series of flights in late June, and by this time now, Gorst had another aircraft and was set to return. They had been flying out of Ketchikan and still really liked the Alaska market. They wanted to get up and work here as soon as possible. So they had been flying there. They purchased a Boeing this time, and it was a Boeing B-1E, which they named the Nugget, and Clayton Scott was still their pilot, and he came with a passenger who was his school teacher girlfriend who came to visit her mother on the 3rd of July. It seems to me that the school teachers of this day were fairly adventurous. They were certainly involved in many early flights, either getting to the villages they served or just as passengers. Well, the Boeing was a biplane, but it was a pusher, so the prop was behind the wing, and that made really good visibility for the passengers, and they did a lot of flight seeing over to the Columbia Glacier, all over Prince William Sound, Valdez Arm. They were packed quite often. They usually had no less than four, and sometimes more, and in all of that, because the flights could be fairly short, they did a number of flights and passengers to Hinchinbrook, Latouche, all of these areas that were just basically made for float service. Well, Scott was eager to return to Ketchikan. He wanted to go there because there was going to be good work supporting the making of the movie The Silver Horde, which was based on a wreck speech novel. It was about to start filming. And then, as soon as that was finished, he was going to be back to Cordova for the filming of another beach novel, The Iron Trail. And that, if you may remember, covered the building of the Copper River and Northwestern Railroad and some of the early fights between the railroad companies between Cordova, Cutala, and Valdez. They were off at 3 a.m., and they were turned back by fog. They departed again at 2:20 p.m., this on July 10th, 1930. Well, the engine started running rough, and they began to realize there was a problem. And with that, I'll leave you as a cliffhanger, and we will take a number of short commercial breaks. And please stay with us. We'll be back soon.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
So how's your memory? Can you remember this name? It's Living Waters Plumbing and Mechanical. It's pretty simple, but it's a name you want to be familiar with. You see, good plumbers who can get to your problem quickly and do a top-quality job fixing it all at a reasonable price. Well, let's simply say they're scarce. Living Waters Plumbing and Mechanical is quick to the problem, and they're quick to the solution. And when you have no heat, or you have a bad plumbing leak, your HVAC isn't working, or your pipes are frozen, you want your problem fixed. So who do you call? I told you to remember the name. It's Living Waters Plumbing and Mechanical. Boilers and water heaters, snow melt systems, of course, drain cleaning. They also own Victory Drains. And you'd be surprised how much more. So look, you don't have to try to remember the phone number. Just remember the name and look it up from there. One more time now. Say it with me. Living Waters. Right, Living Waters Plumbing and Mechanical. Okay, well done.
Wintertime is always awesome at Ivory Jack's. Whether you ski up, arrive on dog sled, or a snow machine, you're always welcome at Ivory Jack's with great weekend breakfasts with mimosas or their famous Bloody Marys. How about the perfect lunch or maybe a nice steak dinner? Swing out on the weekends to Ivory Jack's for live nightly entertainment, and there's always a game on the big screens. Plus free parking, always at Ivory Jack's. Whether it's your car, snow machine, or dog sled, Ivory Jack's in the heart of the beautiful Goldstream Valley.
KFAR weather.
Sunshine mixed with clouds at times this afternoon, with daytime highs approaching 36. Winds out of the southeast, 5 to 10 miles per hour. Lows level off around 18. Tonight, partly cloudy skies. Chance of snow tomorrow, high of 30. Overcast skies. About an inch of snow tomorrow. And that's your weather on KFAR, 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Laura Lockwood.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM,
and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Well, welcome back, Fairbanks. You're listening to Problem Corner on KFAR Radio. We're going to resume our discussion with myself regarding early aviation in Cordova and Valdez. If you'd like to call in, you can, of course, do so by dialing 458-TALK or 458-8255. We'll try to get to your call. I hope you're enjoying today's subject. Well, we had just been talking about Scott getting ready to head with Gorse's aircraft down to Ketchikan to support the movies. The airlines and the pilots at this time all over the state could make fairly good money helping different studios and different photographers take stock photo footage, which could always be used as fillers in different movies. Of course, you know, an amphibious plane like this, they could fly low and along the coast, and then that could be spliced into the movie to show what the trip maybe up through the interior passage looked like, or the coast around Ketchikan or Skagway. So it was a very good moneymaker, again, for the different companies. Well, they were turned back by fog on their first try. The engine started running very rough. They were forced to touch down. They hit the top of a large wave, which broke 6 foot and one of the pontoons off the lower wing. So the airplane had a body like a boat. It was a biplane. And then out on the wingtips were these pontoons for stability so it didn't just rock back and forth entirely too much. They were washed into, and actually swept by winds more, into Icy Bay. They were eventually washed ashore, and the surf really battered the aircraft at that point. The wings were smashed. It was pretty well destroyed. Shortly after the wing losing another wing, a large wave swept over the Nugget, and it pushed it far enough up on shore to be totally out of the water, which was good because it certainly didn't sink with the crew on board. The flights then were, well, that flight was over. So the next morning, they spotted a cabin, walked to it, found food and shelter, as well as a boat. And they took the boat, and they went back over to their aircraft. And what they did was they loaded up everything they needed and decided to set in the cabin because that was going to be a lot more comfortable than what was left of the plane. They were fed, sheltered, so things weren't as bad as they could have been. A number of other airlines heard of the overdue plane. the Alaska Washington Airways sent their Vega to assist with the search. Well, the Vega crew were working the area and finally spotted a flare set off by Clayton. And Ellis, the pilot for Alaska Washington Airways, decided to bring him out, and he landed the Vega on the lagoon. He had to dodge ice to shore, where they unloaded unneeded fuel drums and picked up the Gorsch flyers. I have seen pictures of this rescue being done that were taken by the Gorsch crew, and the Vega, the ice floes were so large that they were within a few inches of the bottom of the wing on the Vega as it taxied in between all of them. Pretty courageous to land, I guess. Very little bit of difference in the wind certainly would have crushed the Vega and put them in a serious straits also. Well, they arrived back then in Cordova at 7:30 p.m. on July 13th, having departed on July 10th. The Washington, Alaska crew departed to pick up Henry O'Malley, and who was the U.S. Commissioner of Fisheries at Naknek. They were thwarted by weather and returned back to Cordova, and then eventually to Juneau and Ketchikan. This trip, though, had triggered their decision to return to Cordova, though that did not happen in 1930, but they realized that there was always, with weather and the number of places you could go, there was always going to be room for more than one airline in the Valdez or Cordova area. Well, Harold Gillam at this point was leaning toward Cordova as a base of operations. Much of his work came from the Copper River communities, and like I mentioned, if they could take things to the end of rail at Chitna, it was quite a little bit easier than flying over from Valdez through the different passes. He was becoming very familiar with the Chitna River, the Nabesna operations. He actually once flew a dentist all the way to Eagle, made trips with perishables often to Tanana Crossing. We know it as Tana Cross. And he had a subcontract to carry mail to several remote mining operations around the Wrangell-St. Elias country. So Gillam was fitting right in. He found a niche, he joined up with it, and did good for himself. On August 3rd, Frank Dorband, who flew out of Anchorage and Fairbanks quite a bit, was ferrying a Fairchild 51, which they had just bought, to Anchorage. And the article I was reading, the newspaper article, said he brought a very rare treat: newspapers, which were only 2 days old. Some of the pilots and others that were traveling would bring newspapers with them. They would not sell the newspapers. They would rent them to as many readers as they could for 50 cents for an evening or 50 cents for an hour. And they would actually, what amounted to, sell the paper several times. Then, often, after selling it to as many people, or renting it to as many people as they could, they would sell it to local hotels and bars to put on their counters. So the newspaper was kind of a different economy than what newspapers are today. Well, Gillam, on that same day, started a business that became very popular across the state. He was working with members of the Alaska Guides Association and was contracting for flying in hunters. He was taking them to a number of locations, pointing out game, and he started working with the guides and bringing hunters in quite a bit. He remained busy serving miners, as if he wasn't busy enough, serving mining interests still out of Copper Center, and on one flight brought in 300 pounds of ore to be tested in the mills. Great variety, whatever would pay, they would haul. He flew for the Alaska Road Commission on route reconnaissance to Nabesna and other locations. He also flew Deputy U.S. Marshal S.J. Nichols to Fairbanks from Valdez on October 16th. On November 6th, he flew to Valdez, stored the Swallow, and headed to the States to hire a new pilot and buy another aircraft for the expanding business. Well, back to Valdez, 1930, Owen Mills had stored his Eagle Rock in October 1929, and aviation had come to a halt. On February 21st, 1930, the SS Alaska docked in Seward after a rough crossing of the Gulf of Alaska. Aboard were the two Swallow aircraft, both registered to Gillam. One was unloaded and sent to Fairbanks by rail, where it was transferred to Percy Hubbard of Service Airlines. Percy also owned Service Motors, another example of an automobile dealer becoming involved with aircraft also. The other was unloaded on the southbound trip at Valdez for Gillam. Gillam had recently returned from Siberia, where he and Joe Crossan had been in on the search for Ben Eielson. He had left Fairbanks on March 18, 1930, in his other Swallow, headed for McCarthy to serve the Copper River Valley. Gillam also had negotiated for the Swallow Agency in Alaska. His flight was ended at Lower Tonsina. Again, the weather had turned very bad. So he landed at Tonsina. From there, he went to Chitna by dog team, then by rail to Cordova, finally to Valdez by ship, arriving March 22nd. So another example of your air flights in those days weren't necessarily point-to-point. His new Swallow was under assembly at Meals' garage. Owen was a licensed A&P mechanic, became the place where most aircraft shipped to Valdez were assembled and maintained. 1st of April, Gillam left for Chitna and McCarthy. He arrived at about 3 p.m., and that was the first flight from Cordova to McCarthy. Nature of business caused Gillam to shift all of his operations to Chitna so that he could get more brought up quickly by rail. It was soon evident a second pilot was going to be needed when the Swallow, which he'd left at Lower Tonsina, was recovered. That was done on April 24th. From then to mid-May, he hauled freight for a number of prospecting parties. And on May 10th, he brought in a man who was only identified as a Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith was one of the first convicts to be transported by air in Alaska. Harold made a number of flight-seeing trips per week as the tourist season opened. Owen Meals now had his Spirit of Valdez operational and did a very good flight-seeing business. He never did go back into an air taxi service. He did particularly well on the days when Gillam was flying freight elsewhere. Both pilots were busy. They made as many as 9 flights between the two of them per day. Gillam, on May 28th, 1930, flew to Fairbanks, and there he tested for and earned his air transport pilot license. Well, other aircraft were occasionally into Valdez, such as Matt Neineman with Alaska Airways Travel Air. A.A. Bennett, the former Fairbanks flyer, came to look at business opportunities for another float operation. Valdez was growing at this particular time. The results of the Great Depression had not slowed them down yet. On June 4th, Meals just decided to test his aircraft's ceiling and was able to climb to 15,000 feet. He was quite awed by a sight common to current passengers. And that's a good place to stop the flying that took place in 1930. Thank you for listening to Problem Corner and myself, Nick Nugent.
Fairbanks, K248DK 97.5 FM Fairbanks, the heartbeat of Alaska.
Ripple effects from a controversial court ruling on Lisa Brady.